50 years ago tonight, a little-known senator named Joseph Raymond McCarthy spoke to a small audience in the steel mill town of Wheeling, West Virginia. The event didn't make the national papers. The local radio station that recorded the talk promptly erased the tape. Yet it was a speech that would eventually mark the beginning of an era in American politics and add a new word to the American language, McCarthyism. Veteran newsman Robert Trout recalls that night in February of 1950.
I wish I could reach into an archive somewhere and retrieve the dramatic moment when I interrupted an evening's entertainment to announce the onset of McCarthyism. It would seem that a moment of such consequence should exist, but I'm afraid that those of us who pursued politicians with intent to commit journalism missed this story completely. I was dividing my time at NBC in those days between hosting a panel show called Who Said That? And getting a weekend newscast on the air. I never saw a word of copy about McCarthy or Wheeling that week, nor would I have expected to. McCarthy's name rarely made news. He had come to Washington in the huge but temporary Republican sweep of 1946. I suppose I must have spoken his name that election night. I was reporting at 2 o'clock in the morning here in New York,
and it's definite. This election of November 5th, 1946, the election of the 80th Congress, has been decided. And for the first time since Franklin Roosevelt swept the Democrats into power in 1932, the Republicans have won control of both the Senate and the House, and by substantial majorities.
When the new majority arrived in Washington in 1947, McCarthy settled quietly into the Senate as the Cold War was taking shape.
Now may we hear from one of the new members of the United States Senate, the Republican Senator from Wisconsin, a member of the Senate Banking and Currency Committee, the Honorable Joseph R. McCarthy. Senator McCarthy.
A few weeks after coming to Washington, and a full 3 years before anyone outside of Appleton, Wisconsin, had heard of him, McCarthy appeared on a program called Town Meeting of the Air. Discussing whether the Communist Party should be outlawed, he might have sounded the keynote of his career then and there.
The Communist Party might well be compared to a huge iceberg in a shipping lane. The most dangerous part of the iceberg is underwater and invisible. And you can no more bring the underground communist organization up to the surface than you can cause that huge iceberg to float upon the face of the sea. Now, it is wishful thinking of the most dangerous kind to urge that the mere passage of a law and that alone can destroy the communist menace.
But in the spring of 1947, the communist menace was as politically premature as McCarthy was unknown. Stalin's threats abroad seemed remote to rural Republicans in Wisconsin. So McCarthy retreated, only to watch Richard Nixon, another one of those fresh Republican faces of 1946, take the initiative on the communist issue 18 months later. By 1950, McCarthy seemed to have missed all the big boats. He faced re-election in 2 years with a reputation among reporters as the worst senator in Washington, a standing made all the more remarkable for a man who spent so little time in the Senate. According to Washington folklore, in the first week of 1950, McCarthy met quietly with three cronies at the Colony Restaurant. Together, they cast about over dinner for any useful unclaimed issues. The St. Lawrence Seaway? Too unexciting. A new share of the wealth plan? Too un-Republican. Finally, someone suggested the menace of communism. The senator got excited. But millions of Americans were already excited. A lot had happened since that spring of 1947. A steady stream of headline shocks had brought the country to the threshold of political panic. Just a few weeks before, I had reported that Russia had the atomic bomb and the subcontinent of China had been captured in a communist revolution. In the last week in January, Alger Hiss's perjury conviction all but put a traitor into the State Department. Then on Monday, February 6th, I went on the air to report the biggest shock of all. An American spy named Klaus Fuchs appeared to have leaked the hydrogen bomb to the Russians. Suddenly, it seemed, anything could happen. When the news is too absurd to be disbelieved, imagination begins to take over. Which brings us back to Senator McCarthy. With Lincoln's birthday coming, Republicans prepared to fan out across the country in their annual speaking offensive. While senior party stars were dispatched to the key cities, the lowly McCarthy drew a comparatively doleful itinerary, ending in Huron, South Dakota. Wheeling was to be his first stop. The GOP National Committee had circulated a list of talking points to keep speakers on message, as we say today. One of the messages was communist infiltration of the Truman administration. Before setting out, McCarthy asked Willard Edwards of the Chicago Tribune to get him some facts. In those days, Colonel McCormick's paper was always eager to play silent brain trust to friendly politicians. With the Tribune's facts and a few notes, McCarthy arrived in Wheeling on the 9th, where 275 guests of the local Women's Republican Club waited in the McClure Hotel. That night, he raised a scrap of paper in the air and told his audience that he held in his hand the names of 205 known communists in the State Department. The next morning, the only report of the speech appeared in the Wheeling Intelligencer. Word also reached the State Department, which issued a curt denial. At NBC, it was way beneath our radar. I was still leading with the Fuchs story. Late that afternoon, McCarthy reached Salt Lake, the next stop on his Lincoln tour. There, a local reporter asked him to confirm the 205 number. The most reliable evidence of what he'd said, the speech itself, had already been erased in Wheeling. But the Salt Lake interview would survive. Here is the first McCarthy charge we have on record. The senator denied he had ever said 205. The number was now 57.
Last night I discussed the communists in the State Department. I stated that I had the names of 57 card-carrying members of the Communist Party. I noticed today that the State Department has denied that. They say they don't know of a single one in the State Department. Now, I want to tell the Secretary of State this. If he wants to call me tonight at the Utah Hotel, I'll be glad to give him the names of those 57 card-carrying communists. Sure. Now, I don't claim to be any FBI or anything, so that when I have the names of 57, you can be right well sure there are a lot more.
It seemed absurd that traitors could be making our foreign policy, and his numbers seemed to change with every press conference. Only McCarthy's audacity and reporters' repeated efforts to pin him down kept this precarious story on life support until it reached Washington, where vast resources of life support stood by for the care and nurturing of absurdity. Within days of the Wheeling speech, cartoonist Herb Bloch sketched a stack of barrels full of mud. He didn't call it mud, though. He invented a new word for it, McCarthyism. Today, McCarthy is the only senator whose name looms as permanently in the dictionary as it does in the history books. I hope you may be wondering at this point how a single speech by an obscure senator in a rather isolated mining town could multiply into such power. The answer is astonishingly mundane. It rests in every politician's most primal drive, re-election. Here's how it happened. After the Wheeling speech, the Senate appointed a committee to investigate the charges. It was headed by Millard Tidings, the great and unassailable sovereign of Maryland politics, who fully expected to be elected to a fifth term in November. When a Senate investigation was scheduled, the national press had no alternative but to report it. We all became trapped in a process that made us unwitting and often helpless captives in an endless procession of accusations. McCarthy was a senator, after all, and senators enjoyed a presumption of authority. In Washington this week, people seemed just a little bit
weary of arguing about Senator McCarthy. On that subject, it's expected that members of the six-man committee to investigate the McCarthy affair will be picked tomorrow. Tonight, at least, no large scramble of any candidates for the positions. Earlier today, the Senate passed...
When the Tidings Committee report was finally issued that summer, it called McCarthy a fraud and a hoax. In any other time, that might have ended it all. But in a peculiar time, when anything seemed possible, the senator branded it a whitewash. Then he directed a campaign of vengeance by circulating a composite photo of Tidings standing alongside the head of the American Communist Party. That November, the invincible Tidings was out, a victim of the dragon he tried to slay on his own turf. McCarthyism suddenly acquired the teeth to enforce its will. A kind of myth took hold in the Senate. If McCarthy could reach into Maryland and snuff out a four-term career like Tidings, he could snuff out anyone's career. From that day forward, no politician, from the president down, could afford to disregard such power. After Tidings, McCarthy was master of the Senate because he was feared. Later, in 1952, a Republican majority in Congress made McCarthy chairman of the Committee on Government Operations and its subcommittee on investigations. The people handed him the authority of government. Sometimes, though, I wonder whether it all didn't start with another election.
NBC Election Headquarters in New York, Robert Trout speaking at 8:15 in the morning, New York time. Over on the board that shows us the summary of the electoral votes, no change. Truman, certain and leading in 27 states. Dewey, in 17 states.
1948 was the election the Republicans were supposed to win, but didn't. If Dewey had won, I don't know how much of our history would be different now. Perhaps not much. Then again, with a Republican in the White House in February 1950, maybe there would have been no Wheeling, no McCarthy, and if so, very likely, no McCarthyism. Our politics might not have fallen into a contest between patriots and traitors, and a generation of Democrats might have felt less obliged to prove their anti-communism in Vietnam. Who would have known that that night in Wheeling 50 years ago would cast such a shadow?
Veteran broadcaster Robert Trout lives in New York City.